Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Anthony from Morningside Heights here in New York, and you're listening to Soundcheck from WNYC.
There's a founding myth to rock and roll. It's the idea of the lone visionary, in this case, the Mississippi bluesman Robert Johnson, selling his soul to the devil in return for fame and fortune. The writer Peter Biebergall says, in fact, without all this soul selling, or at least the appearance of it, rock and roll would never have become rock and roll. Peter is the author of the new book, Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll, and I'm happy to welcome him back to the Soundcheck studio.
John, Peter, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
First of all, let's define the term occult, because you go to great lengths in the book to say that the word has come to mean something very narrow, and you use it in a much broader way.
That's right. I'm really trying to talk about something called the occult imagination, which I think includes not only beliefs and practices that people have, but also the way in which people respond to those beliefs and practices. So, say, a Christian fundamentalist that sees something like a Black Sabbath album being demonic, that's also part of this broad occult imagination. But it's also the way in which these ideas, these symbols, get expressed in culture, in music, in art, and in this case, rock and roll.
Mm-hmm. Now, the word occult, I mean, it literally means hidden.
That's right.
So it seems like as you go through the various, you know, you go from the beat poets to Bowie to T-Rex to the jazz, the astral jazz of Sun Ra, that these things are hiding in plain sight often.
That's right. It seems to be. And sometimes there is a deliberate sense where the musician is trying to, I think, activate something in their fans or the media's sensibility that alerts them very quickly that they're dangerous, that they're different, that they're pushing up against the mainstream. Or maybe it's sometimes just their own inspiration. Maybe something, say, in the way of Donovan, who was influenced not necessarily by the occult per se, but by the myths of the British Isles, or just a whole sense of a romantic return to nature and to simplifying things.
Guinevere of the royal court of Arthur, draped in white velvet, silken lace, the rustle of her gown on the marble staircase, sparkles on fingers slender and pale. The jester, he sleeps, but the raven, he peeps through the dark, foreboding skies o'er the royal town.
It strikes me that a lot of the artists you focus on in the book are English, but the roots of this you trace back to American slavery.
What you have in particular with the slave songs is that even though their worship was Christian, the ways in which they worshiped were taken, I think, directly from their African traditions, which, according to the Christians of the time, would be pagan, barbaric, but it really was the worship of their gods that we can hear, not in the lyrics and not in, I think, what their intention was, but in the sound and in the rhythm and in the style and the energy of the way in which they worshiped comes directly from those pre-Christian African traditions.
So you talk about slaves, shout songs, but you also talk about the circles, the circle dance.
The circle where shout.
You hardly ever even lift your foot off the ground. It's this kind of shuffling thing, very earthy, very rooted, very ancient. And so this becomes part of the DNA of the blues, and then the rhythm and blues, and then Elvis Presley. And at a time where rock and roll is beginning to seem kind of limp and flaccid around the early 60s, that DNA, that becomes the material for that saves rock and roll.
That's right. I think so. And I think obviously it's because it was in many ways the blues that inspired English rock and roll, that they drew from that. There was something about those rhythms and that way of capturing what they wanted to express in music. But you see, say, even with something like Led Zeppelin, that they saw that there was a rich mythological tradition in their own land, mm-hmm. in their country, that they could draw a different kind of inspiration from, more of a spiritual inspiration.
So the opening of your discussion of Led Zeppelin is the mastering engineer trying to engrave on the master disc the phrase from Aleister Crowley, "Do what thou wilt." You know, that this shall be the whole of the law. Do what, and he's engraving it onto the master of Led Zeppelin III. You know, it's like this hidden occult message. But Robert Plant, at the same time, is drawing on Celtic mythology. He's from an area near Wales. He's fascinated by the Western Shore and things like this. So there's a kind of confluence of several different non-mainstream spiritual practices here. Zeppelin III, that is Immigrant Song. You hear the reference to the Western Shore out of Celtic mythology, the Hammer of the Gods out of Norse mythology. It's occult because it is not the mainstream spiritual practice of the time. Is that?
That's exactly okay. Right. And that's right. Really why I'm trying to broaden the idea of this, because really what I'm talking about is at its core, a kind of spiritual rebellion.
Yeah.
And this we see, of course, in this interest for the hippies in particular, in Eastern mysticism, that they needed a spiritual identity that was not bound up in the Judeo-Christianity that what they perceived as ruined the world after World War II. They needed something different. And so they many times looked to the East with those kinds of practices. Now, I think in a very dictionary definition term, Eastern mysticism would not be included in the word occult. But I wanted to include that because it became part and parcel to the idea of the occult in the 60s.
So you talk about the Beatles and, you know, the Maharishi and going to India and studying transcendental meditation and actually kind of doing a bit of proselytizing on behalf of TM. That seems to be kind of a turning point in that, and, you know, people like Donovan doing Season of the Witch. I mean, that period in the mid-60s, everything seems to be coming together there.
That's right. And I think because there was a desperation for meaning in a world that seemed out of control. What's interesting is that even though the hippies maybe were opposed to organized religion, they didn't want to give up on some religious identity. It wasn't willy-nilly. Now, it was, you could say, a Pandora's box, as it were, of all these different spiritual ideas. But they were looking for some way to ground these ideas that felt like there was an ancient wisdom attached to them.
So when you hear a song like Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles, what is the relationship between the texture of the song, the very odd sonic surface of the song, and the kind of spiritual and lyrical underpinnings?
Well, the tool, it seems, beyond spiritual practices was, of course, LSD. And it's an interesting thing that there's something about Eastern mysticism and the occult that gave a language for the LSD experience. They provided a very nice grammar for which to understand an experience that can often feel out of control. Mm. But a lot of those ideas, particularly in Eastern mysticism, are about ego disillusion, breaking down the self, having a sense of oneness with the universe. And so you can, these things went together very well. And I think the music expressed that kind of energy that you get from the mixing of these things.
Pinnacles of 60s psychedelia, Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. Peter Biebergall is with me on Soundcheck. His latest book is called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. How much of this is marketing and how much of this is a genuine kind of spiritual search on the part of the musicians?
I think sometimes it's hard to separate those things because I think, for example, somebody like Jimmy Page who writes that or has his engineer carve the Crowley missive on the inner groove and hires Hypnosis to do these amazing album covers.
They did album covers for like Peter Gabriel. I mean, they were the famous LP cover art group.
That's right. And they did the wonderful, creepy Houses of the Holy cover with the children crawling up the stones. And so there's a sense that, again, that I think that he had a genuine interest in these things.
He bought Crowley's mansion, you wrote.
He bought the mansion. He bought all these rare volumes. And that's how he actually met the filmmaker Kenneth Anger, was because they were bidding on the same Crowley volume at an auction house. So I think that he had a genuine interest in it. Mm-hmm. But I also think that he understood how using these things was a way of creating a mythology and a mystique around the band.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was cynical necessarily. I think you might get that later.
Yeah.
But I do think that there is this really interesting give and take with recognizing that this is going to impact culture.
An interesting example of that, and one that you allude to several times in the book, is the song Mr. Crowley by Ozzy Osbourne. Now, of course, he comes out of the band Black Sabbath, who from note one of album one of that band are kind of putting you in this very sinister, very satanic kind of place, not kind of celebrating it, but to really kind of scare you. And in Mr. Crowley, you're just not sure. I mean, is Ozzy having one over on us? Is he having some fun with us? Is he serious? What's going on here?
I think that he was absolutely having fun, but I also think that he recognized, both as a very smart performer, as somebody who knew that there was a way to sell albums using this kind of imagery, but that there was a real connection between him and the audience when you conjure this spirit, when you conjure these kinds of feelings. And I think when you're a musician up on stage and the flames are exploding mm-hmm. behind you and you walk down your throne and you're singing Mr. Crowley, you feel it too. You feel it also. And afterwards you get it was all in fun. But I think something happens. Something gets evoked between the musician and the audience that I've said many times I think is very similar to what happens when we go to see a magician perform their act. We know it's fake. We know there's nothing supernatural going on over there. But we want that experience of being transported and being hypnotized.
Well, it's a very ambiguous song. It's got lines like, "Hey, Mr. Crowley, won't you ride your white horse?" It's symbolic, of course. Let's hear a little bit from Ozzy Osbourne.
Mr. Crowley.
a little bit of the song Mr. Crowley by Ozzy Osbourne, post-Black Sabbath, post-Black Sabbath version 1.0 anyway. Peter Bibergall talks about Ozzy and Black Sabbath and Aleister Crowley and the history of the occult in the West in his book called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. So you end up with bands like Hawkwind and Into the Future, the kind of astral star child imagery of Yes and Pink Floyd, and also the kind of back into the sort of neo-pagan naturalism, animism, all of that stuff. And all of that actually comes into play with Syd Barrett's Pink Floyd, the early days of Pink Floyd.
Yeah, I think in some ways he became, Syd Barrett in particular, really became a vessel for all the hopes and fears of the counterculture, the way in which there was a combination of using LSD as a tool to get at these other spiritual ideas. But I think it also, that search, that desperate search, can sometimes be a dangerous one. And we see that really with his disillusion of his mind and what happened to him personally.
Right. He became a very famous psychedelic casualty. And these were kids, you know, and they were sort of making it up and trying things out as they went along.
Absolutely.
Peter Bibergall's book is called Season of the Witch, How the Occult Saved Rock and Roll. It is a very interesting read. Peter, thank you very much for joining us again.
John, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Want to know what you think about Soundcheck? Tell us what you think of this segment or about the podcast in general. Email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org, or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's soundcheck@wnyc.org or 866-939-1612.